From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, closing arguments tomorrow in the death penalty trial of convicted killer Gary Lee Sampson. We'll check in with the case and look at what's ahead for Massachusetts courts. Also today, the opioid supply in one Massachusetts town from two perspectives, police and a former dealer.
Once you give someone a free sample, to the addict, that's like a... It's huge, you know what I mean? Because to them, they're like, oh, you're taking care of me. Even though you're really kind of, you know, destroying them.
You can get rid of the supplier all day, but if the user still needs his product or her product, they're just going to go find the other dealer.
Plus, U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera.
It was hard to say that I was Mexican. How could I say I'm Mexican? So I said I was Hawaiian.
All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The death penalty case of Gary Lee Sampson is winding down in federal court in Boston. Closing arguments are set for tomorrow on whether the court will uphold Sampson's 2003 death sentence. Sampson's conviction for carjacking and murder will stand for the murders of three people in 2001, but defense attorneys are arguing for a life in prison sentence instead. WBUR senior reporter David Boyer has been covering this trial. We reached him just after today's hearing and started by asking what happened in court today.
Today was largely had to do with fine points. It's in the weeds of procedures for tomorrow. Closing arguments will take about 5 hours from both sides combined. The one thing that was discussed today that's of great interest is the number of mitigating factors the defense is going to be allowed to present to the jury for Gary Lee Sampson. At the end of the day, the defense will be allowed to present 115 mitigating factors. Mitigating factors are those considerations that either bring some understanding to the defendant's behavior, but they're really a call for mercy from the jurors.
And David, this number of more than 100 mitigating factors is highly unusual. Is that right?
It is. It's close to off the charts. But typically in federal death penalty trials, you have anywhere between 10 to 20 or 30 mitigating factors that are offered. In the case of Zahar Tsarnaev, they presented jurors with 21 mitigating factors. Sampson, in his first trial, presented 19 mitigating factors. That's in the norm of things. But by the way, this is important to note that Michael Burke, who is a leading defense attorney across the country in death penalty cases, this is his formula, to present jurors with huge lists of mitigating factors in hopes of finding anything, one juror out of the whole lot, that will find something in that long list to say, I want to show mercy for Gary Sampson.
And do we know, David, what this high number of mitigating factors might do to jury deliberations? I mean, logically, you would think that it makes them much longer and drawn out and lots of instructions from the judge. Is that what typically happens?
Well, they have to go through this list. Now, they can pass. They don't have to reach consensus. They don't have to vote on each one. They can decide, oh, we're not going to settle this. We're going to move on. That happened in Tsarnaev. But when you have 115 mitigating factors, they, along with the aggravating factors that are presented by the prosecution, have to be on the verdict slip. So there they are. And that's going to be a huge verdict slip for the jury to go through. Now, the question is, you suggest, and then there is some possibility, the jurors become angry about all the choices, all the duties they're facing in the course of this thing. It's a remarkable number of decisions for the jurors to have to make.
What evidence, David, is new in this trial compared to Sampson's first trial?
Good question. The prosecution case is pretty much the same as it was in 2003, with one exception. The prosecution in this trial, in this sentencing trial, has a whole body of evidence of Gary Lee Sampson's behavior while a prisoner, while an inmate in federal prisons and at death row in Terre Haute, Indiana. And that record is important because it's corroborating one of their aggravating factors, which is Gary Lee Sampson is a future threat, that he's dangerous, that they have these attacks he's made on guards, on other officers, statements he's made bragging in prison about the killings that he committed, lots of threats and angry threats, and even video of him attacking one prison guard with a sharpened broom handle. They showed the jurors. So that's on the prosecution side, which is new. Because there's a second trial here that was ordered by the judge, the defense has had a chance to use a new defense. So no longer are they looking at antisocial behavior, mental illness that the first defense presented. Now they're arguing traumatic brain injury, a history of brain injuries, a problem with the executive function that's in the front of the cortex, which involves impulse control. They have presented a long list, as we've been talking about, of mitigating factors here to explain or to ask mercy for his behavior and conduct.
WBUR's senior reporter, David Boweri, who's been covering the Gary Lee Sampson trial. David, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Deb.
For more on the Sampson case and some of the other issues facing Massachusetts courts in the coming new year, we're joined in studio by Nancy Gertner, former federal judge, a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, great to see you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
So this ongoing retrial of Gary Lee Sampson, what's your reaction to this?
Well, you know, I think that the numbers of mitigating factors in one sense is a strategic question. So, for example, it focuses the jury's attention on these things. Hey, jury, you have to then consider these things specifically. Part of the government's challenge was that, in fact, the information could have come in under fewer mitigating factors. So let's pause for a moment. It means the information gets to the jury about his traumatic brain injury, about all the things that might be defenses. And it would the categories then matter only in the sense that the list forces the jury to go one by one, forces the jury to focus. If there was a broad category that said mental illness, they could deal with it peremptorily. Mm. But by making this more specific, they're forced to deal with it one by one. It could increase the jury deliberations. And as David said, they also could, in fact, deal with it as a gestalt. They go through it one by one, but they don't make any they're not obliged to make findings on mitigating factors. They're only obliged to weigh them as against the aggravating factors. They are obliged to make findings on aggravating factors. So on the one hand, this is like telling the jury, please pay attention to these issues in some detail. But beyond that, the information that gets to the jury is really no different.
Hmm. As you know, Frank Gaziano was the original prosecutor in the Sampson death penalty case, and he is now one of the new Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court justices. What did we learn about him during the first Sampson trial that we think might be applicable to his new role on the bench?
I can't really think of anything in particular. I mean, he was a well-respected prosecutor. No one thought that he was underhanded in any way. He did his job exceptionally well. I think that the issue is less what he did in any particular case than something that Senator Warren was concerned about when we were filling vacancies on the federal side, which is it's not that any given prosecutor can't be a terrific judge. There are many, many examples of them. But it's that the bench ought to have balance because it matters where you came from in terms of what you see as important.
Right. Well, you know, we want to talk about that in terms of the makeup of the court in general. It changed last year. It's going to change again this year. Last year, along with Gaziano, there were other members appointed to the bench as well, David Lowy, Kimberly Budd, and we spoke with criminal defense attorney and former state and federal prosecutor Brad Bailey about these appointments, and he said something similar to what you said, that all three people appointed last year had prosecutorial backgrounds. Let's listen.
What was interesting about this last go-round is that all three of the appointees did have prosecutorial experience. You know, there are some that have often felt that over the last few years, some of the appointments, whether at the trial court level or higher, have had a little bit too much of a prosecutorial experience.
So do you think, Nancy, that we need more balance on the court, and how would that be achieved specifically?
Well, as I said, my only experience is when we were filling vacancies, when I was on the part of the committee that recommended to Senator Warren who should fill those vacancies, and she wanted diversity of experience. Mm. Now, why should that matter? It may matter, for example, let's say you have a police officer whose credibility is challenged. If you had no experience in the criminal justice system, you may think that, of course, it's impossible that police officers ever, you know, shade the truth. Mm. Well, if you're a defense lawyer, you might have a different perspective on that. You see things differently. It doesn't mean that where you end up is different, but where you start is different. And particularly in a collegial court, that is to say, that makes decisions as a group, you really want voices from different quarters. How do you do that? Well, it's really going to be up to Governor Baker now with respect to the two remaining appointments that he will have this year to promote diversity of experience. Again, I don't want to say that any given prosecutor will not make a fabulous judge, or any given defense lawyer will necessarily be defense-bound. In fact, it oftentimes happens that defense lawyers are worse on the bench and more strict than prosecutors. But it is a question of everyone has to start somewhere, and the lens through which they start should be different. And then where you finish and where the argument takes you, that's a different issue. But the lens should be different.
But what about when we look at some of the rulings, particularly some of the controversial rulings from the SJC in the past year? Are these rulings made national headlines, which might lead some to believe that this court is very liberal? One ruling said black men may have a legitimate reason to flee police. Another one said that both members of an unmarried couple can be considered parents of a child, even if only one is the biological parent. I mean, what do these things say about the SJC in Massachusetts?
Well, it doesn't say anything new, actually, this year. Since the early 1980s, this has been a court that has been way more protective of rights than the Supreme Court has been, than the United States Supreme Court has been. This is a court that declared the death penalty unconstitutional in the early 80s, that protected choice under the Massachusetts Constitution. So this is not just the past year. Mm-hmm. What is significant about the past year and the coming year is that Governor Baker has an opportunity to get 5 appointments on this Supreme Court.
Let's explain it. That's because of the mandatory retirement.
There's a mandatory retirement, and two additional people who are very fine judges, Margot Botsford and Jerry Hines, are retiring this coming year. So we have really extraordinary changes in the United States Supreme Court that we're on the cusp of, and extraordinary changes in the Mass Supreme Judicial Court. For Governor Baker, it seems to me if he wants to be more than just the not Donald Trump, he has to recognize that the SJC is a treasure and put people on it who will be protective of rights, criminal defendants' rights, civil rights, all sorts of rights as they have been in the past.
But if we look at those three that he already appointed, regardless of the fact that they have strong prosecutorial experience, it would seem that they're rather centrist, at least at this point, if you can generalize. And maybe I'm oversimplifying, but it seems that they're sort of centrist. Does that make you think that Governor Baker then sort of has a handle on where he's going with this? He's got two more. He's done more than half of the 5
right,
that he's likely to do. So where does he go from here? I mean, do you think he has to be extra careful then with those remaining 2, or?
I mean, I'm so reluctant to categorize judges in Massachusetts politics on a centrist liberal, because we've been very, very lucky not to have the kinds of divisions of the national politics in our selections. But there have been giants on this court. Harvard Law professor, you know, Ben Kaplan and Charles Freed and Margie Marshall. There have been giants on this court, liberal, conservative, but giants. People who see the Mass Constitution as a treasure to be interpreted independently of the United States Constitution. That's what it seems to me he should be looking at. And if he means to be someone protective of rights, yes, he should be concerned that these are people who will protect rights more than perhaps the United States Supreme Court will be doing, particularly if President-elect Trump gets to replace three members.
One of the first cases of the new year involves marijuana and determining when someone is driving while high. The SJC will hear oral arguments on this on Friday about the viability of roadside sobriety tests. What are the implications of that case, do you think?
Well, I mean, the one implication is that if it turns out that the sobriety test or that is being that they strike down that test as dispositive of the question of whether or not you are impaired. If they say that the test doesn't prove that and shouldn't be given or shouldn't have those or the results of the test shouldn't be used, then we'll have to come up with different tests to determine when marijuana smoking leads to impairment. I think it's a critical discussion, though, to have because marijuana smoking doesn't map directly onto alcohol impairment at all. You can say with respect to alcohol, a certain percentage of alcohol in the blood typically leads to these kinds of consequences. It's not the same thing with marijuana. And the defense lawyers in this case have a point that you would hate to see driving under the influence of marijuana now replace simple possession as where you go to arrest people who shouldn't be arrested. That said, we should come up with tests. We should come up with real objective tests and not just, boy, he looks stoned to me. Mm-hmm. So if this discussion leads to a broader discussion about what kind of objective tests we could come up with, even though this one may not be it, that's really a good thing. We're all going to have to make these kinds of shifts.
We also have the continued consideration by the SJC of cases handled by former state chemist Annie Ducon. In 2013, she pleaded guilty to falsifying drug tests that used as evidence in criminal cases, yet still no real agreement on how to handle the thousands of criminal cases that were involved. We heard this year that there are 24,000 criminal cases, so the ACLU and others have asked the high court to overturn all the convictions that were based on that faulty testing connected to Annie Ducon. The court heard oral arguments. SJC heard oral arguments on this back in November. So what do you expect from the court in this particular case?
Well, I don't know much about prediction at this point, but I do think essentially what the ACLU is saying to the court is enough is enough. This is not a minor scandal. This is a scandal that sort of goes to the integrity of the court. The only issue in drug cases are what the drugs are. And if that was tainted, then we should do something about it. 25 years ago, these cases would have been dismissed out of hand based on government misconduct.
They would have.
They would have been because there was a very robust law about when the, you know, the government does something that fundamentally undermines the integrity of the proceeding, that you dismiss charges as a way of checking that behavior in the future. That was one approach. The other approach is to say, no, we have to do it case by case. And if you can come up with other evidence to save this prosecution, then you should. The latter approach hasn't worked. How many years are we into this scandal? The latter approach requires an extraordinary amount of resources. Government is concerned, as it should be, about public safety issues. But when there is an illegal search and you suppress evidence, allowing someone who, you know, who is in fact guilty of the crime to go free, these things happen in a system that values rights, and we should value rights.
All right. Former federal judge Nancy Gertner is a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll take a look at the supply of illegal drugs on the streets of one community in Massachusetts. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. More than half of the hundreds of opioid-related deaths in Massachusetts over the past year have involved illegal drugs, typically heroin or fentanyl, bought on the streets. So today, we want to look at the supply of opioids in one community, but look at it from two perspectives, police and someone who was in the drug trade. In a moment, I'll introduce you to a former drug dealer who described his business in Framingham. But But first, we'll start with WBUR's Martha Biebinger, who's on those same streets of Framingham in the back seat of an unmarked police car as she watches an informant buy heroin on behalf of police.
Are you in a position to try to get set up on that spot down there on Pratt?
Four undercover officers watch, each from a different vantage point, as a tall man with long dark hair, his baseball cap pulled low, lopes down a narrow residential street. Framingham Sergeant Sean Riley narrates the steps of this controlled buy.
It's key for us now to keep eyes on the informant at all times.
All right, I got him.
The informant is a man police charged with possession of heroin a few years ago. Now, the man is helping the officers who arrested him collect evidence of drug trafficking. The informant approaches the back door of a house where a suspected target is selling heroin.
Here's the target just came out, standing next to him on the porch.
The informant has $100. Police stopped at an ATM to get the money before frisking him for weapons or drugs and then dropping the informant a few blocks from the house.
This is a really tough spot for us to do surveillance on, because there's a lot of counter-surveillance.
Dealers may spot and trail police, putting the life of an informant at risk.
All right, our boy is away. Target went back in the left side door.
A man who could have been the target in this buy a few years ago is taking my colleague, WBUR's Deborah Becker, on a tour of these same Framingham streets.
I would sell to people working in hospitals, people working with kids, people working in institutions, as far as like jails, you name it, they buy it, you know what I mean? And also, it's not just, you know, like the junkie that's using or the guy on the corner, the homeless guy, it's everyone.
For obvious reasons, this former dealer does not want his name used, and we've disguised his voice. Until about a year ago, he was making quite a bit of money selling heroin in Framingham.
When I first started dealing drugs, it was just coke. Coke was huge. And then two or three years ago, once the doctors stopped being able to give scripts out to people, that's when the heroin just skyrocketed.
And typically, say if you were looking for some to sell, what are we talking about in terms of quantity?
It all depends how, like, you know, if you're a real hustler, if you're just an addict that's just trying to get money back so that you're not sick. I worked up to picking up 100 grams every couple days, and you'd be surprised how fast that goes. And I wasn't the only one picking up that kind of quantity. You can make a decent amount of money in a few days with that.
How much?
$3,000 to $4,000 a day. In the course of 6 months, I had $35,000 saved with me and one other guy, and we would blow money every single day. And we had, like, you know, we had diamond chains on, we had gold watches, strip clubs every night.
As darkness falls this evening, the Framingham detectives who are running the controlled buy take the informant to a deserted parking lot. He hands over a plastic bag of brownish powder about the size of a gumball.
In the Metro West area, that's $100 worth of heroin, about 1 gram.
Sergeant Riley says the price could be half that or less in some bigger cities. The informant will get $40 for his work, a tiny fraction of what he could make dealing heroin for an hour. Riley will aim for three such buys before seeking a search warrant on this target, who Riley suspects is dealing a substantial amount of heroin. So what percentage of heroin on the streets tonight does this 1 gram represent?
Oh, man, that's so minuscule. That's nothing. I mean, if that one house was selling heroin, you could have 15 or 20 other people dealing heroin all at the same time. So yeah, unfortunately, I wish I could say that was what we're hitting the source of supply here in Framingham.
Riley's voice trails off, remembering that police searched a house right across the street from tonight's target just a few months ago. Framingham and Natick have formed a Metro West Drug Task Force, trying to boost their chances against a flood of heroin.
We're really, I think, just trying to keep people on their toes and, you know, try to slow down the supply out there. That's really, are we ever going to stop it? Probably not.
That unending supply is feeding what seems to be a never-ending demand. That dealer, who earlier told us about selling heroin for years in Framingham, says he isn't really sure where the drugs came from. He also says he had a relatively straightforward business plan.
If you know what you're doing, what you would do is you would bag up a bunch of little samples. And then you'd hit areas like this, like downtown, this whole strip.
So this is a hot area, Framingham, this downtown sort of congested area.
Especially in front of the Deskies. I can walk by here, give a few people free samples, give them my phone number, and then wait.
I read this one book that said that folks come into communities and they go a lot of times to treatment centers or AA meetings, and they go to those places and look for clients.
Oh, yeah. I'd go to the clinic or one of the offices that prescribes Suboxone, and, you know, you wait outside, and you'll give someone a sample and give them your number. Or AA meetings or NA meetings. As soon as the meetings are done, you know who's still active and using, and you know who's taking their sobriety seriously, you know? So you approach those people. And like I said, once you give someone a free sample, that to them, to the addict, that's like a, it's huge, you know what I mean? Because to them, they're like, oh, you're taking care of me. Even though you're really kind of, you know, destroying them.
Detectives bring that bag of heroin they took off the streets back to a small office at the police department. Detective Joe Godino snaps on blue latex gloves.
You've been testing a lot of fentanyl.
That's the opioid, up to 50 times more powerful than heroin.
So we usually always wear gloves.
And police keep naloxone, the drug that could help reverse an overdose, in the office in case detectives accidentally inhale fentanyl or get it on their skin. Godino pulls a pair of tweezers from a drawer and picks at a minute nut atop the gumball-sized plastic baggie.
What they do is they'll take a sandwich baggie, they'll pour it in the corner, they'll spin it off, they'll tie it, and they cut it.
Godino drops the tweezers to open the pouch and discovers this gram of heroin is double-bagged.
You'll see this a lot with people who sell it out of their mouths. They want to make sure it's not going to be leaking in the mouth when they're carrying it. Or if they swallow it, they want to make sure that they can go to the bathroom and have it come back out.
Godino scoops a pinch of the powder into a small test tube.
So you put it in the test kit, you bang it down towards the end.
The powder mixes with chemical agents that turn yellow if the drug is fentanyl, or in this case, purple.
And that's how you know that this is heroin. No doubt about it, that's heroin.
This heroin will be stored in the evidence room. A Framingham police officer is under investigation because of money missing from that evidence room. One criminal case has been dismissed as a result. Framingham police say they could keep 25 detectives busy all day, following up on tips like the one that led to this bag of heroin.
The former dealer we spoke with earlier says he stopped selling drugs after he got caught. When he was dealing, he says, he was always on guard, taking steps to stay away from police and people looking to steal his money and drugs.
I'll find an addict who has an apartment. I'll give him a couple bags a day so that he's not sick and he's high for free, so I can sell drugs out of his apartment all day. So when the cops come and they get a search warrant for that apartment, that apartment's not under my name. And the thing is, you can't trust anyone. You're always watching your back. I mean, I barely slept because you just never know who's gonna come and kick in your door. You take so many steps. It's like you have to literally watch where you're going, watch who you're talking to, have eyes behind your head.
Sounds awful.
Oh, it's terrible. It's a nightmare. It's when you're out of it, you know, in hindsight, you're like, wow, like, I don't know how I actually did all that. But when you're in the moment and you're in the zone, the money controls you. You know what I mean?
Did you ever get hurt?
No, like, I've never had anything like that happen to me because I've earned my respect. You know what I mean? Like, if I've had to do something to someone, you know, because they owed me money or they shorted me or something, then I did it. You know what I mean? And if that's hurting someone or whatever, then I had to do what I had to do.
Our former dealer and the Metro West detectives lived in competing worlds. But today, they agree about the best way to fight opioid addiction. The focus, they say, must be on slowing the demand for drugs. Here's Sergeant Riley.
You can get rid of the supplier all day, but if the user still needs his product or her product, they're just going to go find the other dealer. And they're going to just keep on pumping it out.
Yet the Metro West Drug Task Force forges ahead while the rate of opioid deaths continues to rise across Framingham and Massachusetts. It's estimated that 5 people now die every day in this state because of opioid use.
Sergeant Riley says with every arrest, he hopes to make it a little harder for users to get heroin or fentanyl.
Maybe it takes one or two people and it turns them around. I look at that as a success.
Framingham Police are among the departments in Massachusetts that have started guaranteeing treatment to users who overdose. The department's also working with local health and school leaders on substance use prevention projects, realizing there is no magic bullet that's going to stop the wave of opioids on their streets. Research finds that about half of us make New Year's resolutions, and the majority of those involve health goals like weight loss and exercise. And it says right now, at about day three of the new year, many of us are probably having a hard time keeping those resolutions. We've asked Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog, to join us to talk about this. Welcome, Carrie. Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too. And indeed, personally, whenever I've tried to diet, right around now, day three is when I usually blow it.
So how do we not blow it? What does the research say?
Well, first of all, the big picture. There's this whole evolving science about behavior change. And in particular, there's a trendy acronym for setting goals, for how you should set goals. And it's SMART, S-M-A-R-T. It suggests that your goals should be S for specific, M for measurable, A for action-oriented or achievable, R for realistic, and T for time sensitive.
So you don't say I'm going to exercise more. You say I'm going to exercise maybe three times a week. Walk Monday, yoga Wednesday, bike on Friday.
Right. And you're supposed to choose goals that you're really confident that you can reach. And what's really important is you don't want to overreach. That's something I learned from Dr. Eddie Phillips. He's the director of the Institute of Lifestyle Medicine at Harvard Medical School.
And your co-host on the exercise podcast that we launched last year, the magic pill.
That's right. Here's Dr. Phillips. He's talking about the importance of setting smaller milestones to start, and then you can ask yourself, what's next?
People hear I should exercise, and they think marathon. Mm-hmm. And I say, not yet. Keep that big, audacious goal, but let's talk about the smallest change you could make that we're going to give you credit for, and by tomorrow you'll say, wow, I did that. It may be 500 steps at the end of the day, take you about 5 minutes. But you set the goal and you achieved it.
And Carrie, you recently wrote on Common Health that working on the magic pill was something like a conversion experience for you.
Yeah, it really was. I wrote this post that I headlined, Sex, Chocolate, and Exercise, the Wonderful News About Fitness in 2016. And basically, it was about some cutting-edge research on how to motivate yourself to exercise. And it suggests that the key is to shift your mindset from thinking about exercise as a chore or a pain to seeing it as a treat or even a joy.
Well, seems like common sense. If you hate it, you probably won't do it.
Right. And you won't do it if you feel like you're supposed to do it and only in a certain way. So fitness motivation expert Michelle Seeger talks about how many of us have been taught to exercise only in a very prescriptive way and how that thinking is not always the best approach.
Now, sidestep over to another topic. Imagine how people would feel about sex if they were prescribed how to do it. Get in this position, breathe at this, you know, rate. I mean, think about it. It would turn even something as glorious as sex into a chore.
So that's the sex that I wrote in the headline. And the chocolate is Dr. Phillips' idea that we can respond to exercise the same way we respond to, let's say, sweets at a holiday party.
You're losing me there.
Yeah, okay. Because Michelle Seeger talks about how one of the biggest motivators for people to exercise is that we want the immediate emotional response it brings. Like, we think it will make us feel good, fast, like yum, like chocolate, and we want that.
Another question, though. Lisa Feldman Barrett, a neuroscientist at Northeastern, writes in the New York Times this week that if you want to become a so-called super ager, someone whose mind is sharp, right, into old age, you need to work very hard at mental tests. Uncomfortable. You have to get uncomfortable. Not crossword puzzles, but really tough mental challenges to exercise that brain muscle.
Right. She says because when you perform difficult tasks, whether they're mental or physical, you're keeping certain key regions functions of your brain healthy. Yes. But of course, the challenge is that if something's hard, it's like, oh, hard. It's unpleasant. And Feldman-Barrett says you have to expend effort at least until you hit the point of some yuck.
And that doesn't sound like chocolate to me.
It's not chocolate. But here's another thing I learned doing the magic pill, that vigorous exercise is great, and maybe it's an acquired taste. But when it comes to physical activity, everything counts. Every set of stairs, every push-up, it's just about all good for your health. It's all good.
Well, Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog and the Magic Pill podcast. You can find both of those at our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. When we spoke with the first Mexican-American to be U.S. Poet Laureate about this time last year, we didn't know then who was going to be the country's next president. And President-elect Trump had not yet talked about building a wall. So the poems of Juan Felipe Herrera, many about the realities of being Latino in the U.S., seem even more pressing now. This is him reading the beginning of his poem titled, Every Day We Get More Illegal.
Every day we get more illegal. Yet the peach tree still rises and falls with fruit and without. Birds eat it, the sparrows fight. Our desert burns with trash and drug. It also breathes and sprouts vines and maguey. Laws pass, laws with scientific walls, detention cells. Husband with the son, the wife and the daughter who married a citizen, they stay behind. Broken, slashed, unpowdered in the apartment, to deal out the day and the puzzles, another law, then another, Mexican, Indian, spirit, exile, migration.
That's U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. When he visited our studios, we began by talking about how he was influenced by his family.
My parents were born before the Mexican Revolution, before 1910. My father was born in 1882, and my mother around 1907. And my father crossed into the United States as a 14-year-old teenager, already a man in his world, to find a new life in Denver, Colorado, jumped on a train from Chihuahua, northern Mexico. And my mother came at the very tail end of the Mexican Revolution, around 1918 or 19, with my grandmother and her sister, Aurelia. My uncles had already arrived in Fort Bliss, El Paso, Texas, to join the army in order to bring the rest of the family. So that's the backdrop of my parents. And we grew up, I grew up as they worked the farms and the fields in the very, very early 50s. And that influenced my life because I was in that world until I was 7 years old. And then from there on lived in barrios and outskirts and trailers and mountains and ranches. And by the time I was 7 years old, I finally made it to Escondido, California, and San Diego, California, where I met Mrs. Lelia Sampson in third grade, who really, really touched me and told me that I had a beautiful voice. I stood up in class. She invited me to sing, and I did. And that's what she told me. And it was a riddle. It was a life path.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. So what did you sing?
I sang Three Blind Mice.
Really?
I sang Three Blind Mice. And, I couldn't believe, now I can't believe that I actually stood up and walked over to the head of class and turned around and faced the class and sang a song, Three Blind Mice. And then she turned around and says, you have a beautiful voice. And we've been talking. She's 95 years old now.
Really?
And we found ourselves again.
Oh.
Because I mentioned this all the time because it was a pivotal moment in my life. And so we say hello now, and she found out through the newspaper.
Oh, my gosh. Now, why was that so pivotal for you, do you think? Just confidence? Or what was it that...
Because she gave me the language, and it was confidence, and she noticed me. Before that, I was completely double 100% invisible because I had been hurt in the classroom by the teachers. And I had seen so much visible pain in my friends, students, second grade as well. So third grade, I definitely wasn't about to get up in front of class and sing. And that happened. And by the end of the year, I was singing solos with the choir, her choir, gospel, in front of the rest of the assembly of the school, Lowell Elementary in Logan Heights, San Diego.
When you say that you were hurt by the other teachers and things, what do you mean? You were looked at differently because of your background?
Well, I was probably looked at differently. What happened was when I first went to school, no one knew in our family what it really was. It was a building, and that's all. My mother had an idea. She made it to third grade in El Paso, and my father didn't know about schools because he was out in the country all the time as a young man, and he learned English by buying words for a penny, English in English. How do you say leche in English? ¿Cómo se dice? Milk. Milk. Oh, milk. So that's how he learned his English.
Oh,
So I walked in, found the door. I opened whatever door I saw, and I was late. Apparently, I was late. And I spoke in Spanish, you know, ¿qué está pasando? Yo no sé. And what's going on? And my teacher called me over to the corner, and she spanked me and put me over her knee and spanked me in front of all the children. And that was shocking for me because my mother was the opposite. My mother would teach me songs and read me whatever books she could find in the secondhand store, and I was the only child. So imagine how cared for I was by my mother, and to go from her and
to get spanked
and, you know, and hit with rulers when I blurted out in English. So when I made it to third grade, Mrs. Sampson pulled me out of that world. And then said that I had a beautiful voice to me. She directed herself to me. That my voice, whatever that was, you know, my voice, what is that? And it's beautiful. Well, what is that? So I had to block that phrase. And now, and then I had to challenge myself. I had to find a way of expressing myself. It wasn't just, okay, I know this. I didn't understand it. It didn't make sense. I denied it. But by seventh grade, I said, Mr. Schuster, music teacher, says, well, what are you? What are you, John? I said, why is he asking me that? What am I? This is seventh grade in Roosevelt Junior High in San Diego. What am I? What am I? What am I? What are you? What am I? Oh, I said, I'm Hawaiian, because I had come in from the Bay Area. And I said, that's about the best I can do. I'm not able to say Mexican. I'm Hawaiian. Because I felt it was hard to say. It was hard to say that I was Mexican. How could I say I'm Mexican? My parents are so poor. I am, you know, so poor. I don't even live in a house. And if I do, I don't want people to come over because I'm not like everybody. I had all those things just swirling and boiling and smoldering. So I said I was Hawaiian. And then, of course, I said, that's it. I'm not going to lie anymore. Right there and then there, I walked out after class, and I said, that's the last time I lie about who I am. I'm not going to take band. Mr. Schuster invited me to be in band. I love music. I wanted to be in that band. I wanted to play saxophone. I loved saxophone. I put $5 down on a saxophone on Pawn Shop Row in San Diego. And at the Apex a music store on Pawn Shop Row where people left their instruments. It was a beautiful tenor sax. But I'm not going to do what I said. I'm going to go into choir. I have no choice. Mm. That's the only way I'm going to learn how to speak out. So I engaged in a journey of training myself to be able to speak and not to lie from then on.
Wow.
That's it.
And to sing.
to sing. But it was an excuse to sing in my mind.
Yeah.
I really wanted to speak and tell the truth.
That's incredible. But you know, What do you, how was it that you were able to, I'm sure that there are, as you know, many children who struggle with this, feeling different, feeling like outsiders, not having resources, embarrassed sometimes by their family before they get that voice and say, I am who I am and I'm going to believe in that and make a stand for that. Why did you have the, you know, foresight and then the resilience to now become the U.S. Poet Laureate after that?
Well, you know, everything. I was in a moment where things were changing radically, and I saw them and I listened to them, and I followed them. I was attracted to them. I was attracted to Martin Luther King. How he spoke, he stood up. I said, "How does he do that?" You know, I was very young. I said, "How does he do that?" I would see people on the street or at school talking to each other in a group and being very easy about it, and how natural it came to them. I go, oh, I wish I could do that. And I saw people standing up in the free speech mounds, and whether it was in high school and then at UCLA when I first went in 1967. I go, oh, I wish I could do that. Oh, geez. Yeah, I was just at awe. And I was, you know, just holding my hands and put them on my face and wanting to do that. And my friends were poets. And we were all everybody was talking. And then we had the Vietnam War. And then we had Martin Luther King. And then we had Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez and Malcolm X. All speakers. Mm. All amazing, powerful speakers with great audiences and an amazing cause. A beautiful, real, soul-rattling cause. And I believed in that. My mother taught me to love others and to be kind. And she had a hard life, and my father had a hard life, and they were elders by then in the 60s. And I wanted to do something for them and for others like them and farm workers. And I saw Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, Malcolm X, and I had this little personal secret project of being a speaker. So all those things, and my friends were poets, all those things just fused together, and I took the challenge.
Tell me about your personal project. Would you practice in front of a room to see how you would speak?
I did. My personal project was that secret that I wanted to be a speaker and that I didn't want to be fearful anymore. I didn't want my voice to tremble and squeak. And I didn't want to be afraid, most of all. I didn't want to be afraid. And I wanted to say things. I don't care what they were, you know, Milky Ways, Popeye, it didn't matter. And then I found a cause that really put everything together for me. It was the fire that warmed me and guided me. And my other like side projects, like you said, were practicing in front of a mirror, or were getting a book with long poems by Wordsworth or Longfellow, or even Garcia Lorca that I discovered in the Mission District in a Spanish bookstore. And I would get the poem and put it in front of me and recite it out loud like an oratorical project. And I waved my hands in the air as if I was directing the choir or an orchestra. And I would recite those words in a little tiny apartment on 11th Street in San Diego. That was three blocks from high school. And no one knew that what I was doing. Not even my mom. She was in the next room somewhere attending to things. And that's what I would do, because I wanted to do that bad.
And your cause, you said, until you discovered your cause, mm-hmm. Your cause was to write?
No. You know, my cause was to assist others. My cause was to bring out our histories and stories to our larger community, which didn't have books, which were being blocked out of schools, which didn't have resources, that were laborers, that were in East L.A., that were farm workers, that were students as well, that were working really hard to go to the university, and everyone. My cause was not my cause. My cause was the cause of the people. And I took that on very early. And I guess that's what pulled me out of that little dark room, even though I was still nervous and I was still squeaking my voice. But at least I was standing up with poems and with my friends using their musical instruments.
I'm glad you're writing. Are you still singing?
I'm still singing. I have a harmonica, a guitar.
Yeah.
From folk song movement days in the 60s as well. Those were singing days and guitar days.
Yeah. Do you sing Three Blind Mice?
You know, I think I need to bring it back up and sing it. Why not? You know, three blind mice, three blind mice. And let us be full-sighted human beings with open hearts and embracing poems and embracing lives.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in. It was a terrific, terrific to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
That's U.S. Poet Laureate Juan Felipe Herrera. We spoke with him last January. And if you want to hear him read his entire poem, Every Day We Get More Illegal, you can find it at our website, radioboston.org. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Brzezek. We had help today from Cassandra Sunt and Ashley Bailey. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.